Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Hospice New Zealand Genesis Oncology Trust Lecture 6. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. This morning, there will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded, and at this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Our speakers today are Professor Rod McLeod and Anne Morgan. Professor Rod McLeod is Senior Staff Specialist in Palliative Care and Conjoint Professor of the University of Sydney. He has published extensively in clinical and spiritual aspects of palliative and supportive care and in the education of healthcare students and professionals. Anne Morgan is currently the Practice Advisor at Hospice New Zealand. She has worked in the oncology palliative care area for over 30 years and has recently developed a national palliative care education program for residential aged care. We are delighted they can join us today. Welcome, Rod and Anne. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. It's great to have you all up so early, especially you in Australia, Rod. It's only 5:30 for you. So,
it's part of my dedicated service to the Hospice New Zealand organisation and the palliative care community in New Zealand. It's great to be here, actually. Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Well, Rod and I thought we would, again, revisit the basics. And I hear many of you thinking, oh, we know this. But mouth care is considered one of the most basic of nursing activities. And palliative care patients, one of the most vulnerable to oral problems. If you just go to the next slide. Despite being an essential element of caring for palliative care, patients, there are repeated studies that show that oral care is still deemed insignificant or of minor importance, and yet we know the presence of oral problems can profoundly affect quality of life. And so we need to be really thinking carefully about how we are managing oral care in our hospices and in our aged care facilities where the greatest problems occur. Next slide. When it, we're thinking about this, we need to really be thinking about why do we need to worry about oral care at all? And this presentation is really going to review some of the following reasons. We've already established that patients at the end of life are vulnerable to oral problems, and there are a significant number of studies that have been done both in hospices and in community settings to show what a problem it is. We know that the impact of oral discomfort impacts on many aspects of the lives of patients and residents, and that people at the end of life are frequently exposed to compromising factors, and we're going to look at some of those. And research has also ranked dryness in, of the mouth in patients with advanced disease as the third most distressing symptom. Moving on. So, from a patient's perspective, after pain and nausea control, the ability to communicate easily, to taste and enjoy food, to be nice to be near are actually of paramount importance. Unfortunately, the side effects of many of the medications that we use at the end of life and those who've had chemotherapy are very prone to problems with dry mouth. The anticholinergic agents used in palliative care compromise the mouth by affecting the salivary flow, and that goes on obviously to affect the mucosal stability and alteration in the oral microflora, which can then lead to infection. The mouth supports an extensive range of bacteria, and if this becomes altered, then infection will ensue. Often they're not able to drink as much, they're generally debilitated. And some of the other medications also that we use, like the antidepressants, which are often used for pain management, have significant impact on the saliva. And so we have to choose very carefully which of those drugs we use. we know that amitriptyline has worse effects than citalopram, for example. The oral cavity requires that moisture for its integrity, and it has a high turnover of mucosal cells being replaced every 10 to 12 days. So chemotherapy and radiotherapy are obviously going to interfere significantly with this mucosa, and it can become atrophic and easily injured. And then we get those breaks in the mucosal integrity, and we're going to end up with ulcers. Moving on to the next slide. The sad thing is that even patients don't rank it. And there was a very interesting Australian study where they looked at what patients had actually said about their oral care or their oral issues. And many of them actually stated that they had mentioned that they had oral problems, but because the health professionals didn't respond particularly to that, they felt that it was insignificant and that these symptoms weren't actually clinically important enough, and so they often failed to report the problem even when it was giving them significant grief. And I've mentioned the reference for that study there, and I can send that on to you. It was a very interesting study to read. Moving on to the next slide. The range of oral problems reported by the participants in the Australian study affected obviously not only their physical but also their social and emotional effects. And a deficit was noted in the study of a thorough and structured assessment of the participants' mouths. They mentioned things like their comfort, their loss of enjoyment of food, loss of appetite, their inability to actually maintain any sort of nutrition. They had swallowing difficulties. There was poor protection from infection, and they had difficulty communicating. So moving on to the next slide. Psychologically, it led to huge frustration. There were changes in patient behaviour, such as actually avoiding eating or refusing to eat in the presence of others. And they avoided a number of foods and fluids that they would have previously liked. The loss of taste meant a general lack of enjoyment of any food, and many of them reported being sick of having to eat mush and actually choosing not to eat rather than to have that mushy food. They found it unbearable at times, and this frustration led to annoyance and anger. And worse still, they couldn't always communicate well because of slurred speech from that dry mouth. Moving on. There were social effects. Obviously, if they couldn't communicate well, then they chose to just shut up rather than get into an embarrassing situation where they weren't actually understood. The social impact of not being able to enjoy and share meals with friends and families meant that they often isolated themselves and limited the social outings they went on, and they didn't want to participate in special occasions. And because halitosis is a problem, if there are oral problems, then they avoided any close physical contact. And, you know, when you're coming to the end of your life, it's pretty sad when you can't have that as to comfort you. So these oral problems were a significant issue, and the results of the study were supportive of oral care being raised to a clinical priority in the work environment. Moving on. So we need an individualised care regime. We need timely oral care assessment, and Rod in a moment is going to go on and talk about that, and an individualised regime to establish the frequency and type of care that's required in order to limit the occurrence of oral complications. Without an effective assessment of the mouth, then the appropriate implementation of care cannot be planned. You might like to think about what assessment tools you are using in your facilities at the moment. as I hand over to Rod to talk more about those oral assessments. But moving on, I'll hand over to you, Rod.
Thank you. So on this next slide, slide 10, we've just put down some key questions for mouth care, which you, I'm sure, are all used to carrying around in your head. Every time you go to see a new patient, every time you go to see somebody that you've been looking after for a long time, some of the questions that you should be asking are, is infection present? Is the mouth dry? Is the mouth dirty? Those are all things that you can see with your eyes. You can use your nose, as Anne says, to detect the presence of halitosis. And you can ask if the mouth is painful. Now, this may seem fairly basic, but I think if those four questions are asked each time, before you have a look and methodically check around the mouth, then at least you're going to identify the problems that that these people have. If you go to the next slide, this is a slide of one of the Hospice New Zealand staff. She was on holiday in New York at the time. You can see that there have been various efforts at trying to minimize the effects of mouth breathing. Now, mouth breathing is remarkably common in the population, and you can probably look around your friends and recognize the mouth breathers for all sorts of reasons. People get into the habit of it. They start off by having nasal problems and end up having to breathe through their mouth all the time. And some people will go to great lengths to try to stop the mouth breathing, which, as some of you will know, dries your mouth out and makes it feel pretty unpleasant in the morning. Next slide, slide 12. Now, if there's one thing that you're going to take away from this talk, we thought that having everything on one slide might be quite a useful way. And I'm going to come back to refer you to this slide towards the end of the preparation. But this is really a methodical way of looking. I'm not going to go bit by bit through it now, but it's a methodical way of looking at oral health assessment. And starting with the lips, which are obviously the most obvious part of the oral assessment, and working your way through the tongue and the mucosa and so forth. And using it as a checklist. Now, if, for example, you were going to undertake an audit of mouth care, it would be quite simple to create a grid whereby for every patient that you saw, you went through and ticked that you'd checked their lips and tongue and mucosa and so forth. Because I think one of the things that happens in all aspects of healthcare is that we become so accustomed to taking shortcuts because we see things frequently that we tend to nod and say, oh, yeah, no, that mouth's okay, or no, it isn't. And the vast majority of the oral cavity is hidden from view unless you look specifically around, tuck up in beside the teeth, push the tongue down to look just over the edge of the tongue. And so this slide was created as a sort of aid memoir. It's small enough, really, that you could print it off and have it as a handy reminder in the front of everybody's health records, or stick it onto Palcare so that it pops up every time. It's just a thought that we felt was worth floating to you who do this every day. So moving on to the next slide, we go in a little bit more detail about the oral assessment. And the first thing that you will notice about the patient that you're caring for is there may be a change in their voice. As Anne's mentioned, there may be some slurring of the speech, some thickening of the speech. And it's important to ask the family if the voice has changed, or to ask the person themselves if their voice has changed. You can just imagine this for yourself when you've been to the dentist and had part of your mouth numbed, or you've got an ulcer on the end of your tongue or something, you do speak in a different way, and those close to you will notice that there is a difference. So voice is the first one. The second one is swallowing. Have you noticed anything changing in your swallowing? And just yesterday I was helping to care for a woman who, her main problem is that she gets this unusual sequence of pains related to her swallowing. She starts off the swallowing, the initial movement of the food across the back of her tongue, and she gets a pain on one side of her throat, and then as she swallows and goes further down, the pain moves and appears in another part of her throat. And when we looked in her mouth, it was quite clear that she had significant oral and probably esophageal candidiasis. Now, it may also be that there's something else wrong with her throat, but until we clear up the candidiasis, we're not going to be able to be sure about that. What about the texture of the lips? So they've told you, they've demonstrated their voice, they've told you about the swallow. Now it's your turn to use your eyes. Look at the lips. What do lips normally look like? What do your lips normally look like when you look at them in the mirror to put your lippy on or to when you're brushing your teeth? Are they dry? Are they cracked? Are they bleeding? Those are all clues as to what may be going on. And then once they open their mouth, look at their tongue. What sort of coating does it have? Now, you'll know that the majority of people, especially the mouth breathers, will have a coating on their tongue, and it's normally recognized as just the mouth breathing coating. But it may be that the tongue has got blisters on it, it may have deep fissures, it may have a geographical appearance, or it may just simply be dry. So record all of those. How much saliva is there? Are they overproducing saliva so that they're dribbling out and having to clear it away? Or are they underproducing? We'll come on to the salivary glands at the next slide. But just for the moment, once you've looked at the amount of saliva, check around all the mucous membranes. And that means lifting up the upper lip, pulling down the lower lip and getting a torch to look inside. Again, you're looking for unusual coatings, ulcers, bleeding. And then the last two, you need to check the gums. Is there swelling there? Is there redness there? Are the gums bleeding? Some of the drugs that we use, valproate for example, can lead to swollen, reddened gums. And finally, look at the teeth or look at the dentures. People can be very funny about their teeth and not want to take them out. I know Anne's like that. but it is important to check and make sure if there's debris left behind. Part of the function of the saliva is to help to lubricate the mouth, to wash away the debris. As you get older, you get longer in the tooth, and there is more space for debris to lodge up in amongst those little nooks and crannies. How much plaque is there? So all of those, it only takes a minute to do all of that. Once you get yourself some sort of methodical way of doing it, you can do it in less time than that and make sure that you haven't missed out anything. So the next slide. The next slide is just a drawing pinched from Google demonstrating the site of the major and minor salivary glands. And you'll be familiar with those. They're dotted all around. Now, sometimes towards the end of life, you can get strange swellings in the salivary glands. I can remember a long time ago, in the 80s, when I first started palliative care, having three people in a row in over a period of about 2 weeks, and all of them had swollen salivary glands. And the first time I saw it, I thought, oh, goodness me, this person's got mumps, because she had a significant swelling in her parotid gland, and it was tender, and it got worse when she went to eat. And I thought, oh, no, this is most unusual. And then a couple of weeks later, another one turned up. And I thought, oh, goodness, you know, we've got a rash of mumps coming along here. But though, what it was that these people had parotitis, an inflammation in their parotid gland. Two of them had little stones in their salivary duct that we could milk out. Once we milked the stones out, all the swelling in the salivary glands went. So there is a real risk that if your saliva gets more thickened, and it can clog up in the drainage tubes and cause this really very, very painful and unpleasant swelling. Next slide, I think. Is that slide 15? So what is saliva for? We've got all these glands around the place, so what is it there for? It's there to clean and lubricate the mouth. It's there to buffer against the strong acids or the strong alkalis that we tend to put in our mouth, fizzy drinks, and some people have been known to put alcohol in, and the saliva helps to buffer that to so that it has less of an effect on the, less of a damaging effect on the mucosa. It helps with remineralization, and it does have antimicrobial properties. So you can, if you don't have enough saliva, you are therefore more prone to having infections, microbial infections in your mouth. It helps with taste, it helps with digestion, and maybe most importantly, it helps to maintain the mucosal integrity. It helps just to hold everything apart. Now, the next slide is again a bit of repetition, because there's nothing wrong with repeating. And you'll notice that through this presentation, we do repeat things a few times, and we do that deliberately just to try to make sure that the points that we worry about are going home. So why do people get a dry mouth? Well, some people get a dry mouth because they're dehydrated. It's interesting, though, that the perception of thirst can be a purely local effect, and mouth breathers might feel more thirsty than non-mouth breathers. But if you are dehydrated, you may tend to produce less saliva. Just at the moment, and every time I give a talk, I get a very dry mouth. Now, that's partly because I'm talking and the air is going across my tongue all of the time, but it's partly because I'm anxious. And a lot of people that we look after near the end of life have a degree of anxiety, and that then itself will produce a dry mouth. As Anna's mentioned, a lot of the medications that we use, ranging through from the anticholinergics through to the opioids, through to sleeping pills and antidepressants, many of them will produce a dry mouth. And other things like diabetes or even liver cirrhosis can produce this this appearance on the picture that you've got in front of you. The next slide looks at structural reasons why people might have a dry mouth. Well, it may be that their salivary glands are underdeveloped in the first place, and they may have always had a dry mouth. As Anne's mentioned, they may have had radiation therapy. They may have Sjögren's syndrome, dry eyes, dry mouth. So there may be a lack of tears as well as a lack of saliva. They can have infections. There may be rare examples of graft versus host disease. And for those of you that follow House on the television, we've had to put in something quite unusual. And so sarcoidosis can produce a dry mouth as well. So if you can't produce your own saliva, well, what are the options for replacing it? And the next slide just shows some of the possibilities for replicating saliva. Now, part of the historical replicants was glycerin and thymol, and it was thought that this is a nice sort of soothing, smoothing replacement for saliva. But because that's hygroscopic, that is, it draws water into it, it can paradoxically cause a sense of dryness so that you use it again and again. Carboxymethyl cellulose with buffers and calcium and fluoride, that's one of the preparations which is available. It's made from plant material and can produce a very pleasant and slightly slippery feeling in the mouth. And there's one called saliva orthana. Part of the problem with that one is that it contains animal mucin. And so it's important, as it is with any of these preparations, to make sure that you're not giving a vegetarian something with animal products in it, or using animal products for somebody whose religious beliefs prevent them from taking in animal products. So it's well worth checking on the side of the bottle to see whether the preparations that you're choosing to offer people contain only plant material. Just make sure that some of them have animal products and shouldn't be used. So because of my dry mouth, I'm just going to have a little sip on my morning tea and hand you back over to Anne for the next couple of slides.
So how are we going to go about stimulating saliva and helping these people with this problem? Well, candies and mints are really good. Any sorts of candies. Some of the patients that I worked with often like to suck on those acid drop boiled lollies and got quite a hit of saliva from those, or suck any mints. Chewing gum. Rod will talk a bit more in a minute about the salivary stimulants that can be used. And some lifestyle adaptations, so changing from the sweet fizzy drinks to diet drinks because of the lower pH, and reducing caffeine and alcohol can be useful as well, although for some of us reducing the alcohol, Rod, would be very difficult. There was an interesting study that I read too that was done in, it was only a small study, but it was done on hospice patients in Sweden, where they used acupuncture, and they actually found that acupuncture did significantly increase the salivary flow, and they measured that by a visual analog scale that the participants filled out, but they also actually measured the saliva production. And all of the participants reported significant improvement in the dry mouth. The downside to that study was that acupuncture had to be given over a 5-week period, so for many of our hospice patients, they may not actually survive 5 weeks to enjoy the stimulation of the saliva. But they did also get improvement in dysphagia and dysarthria much earlier than that, so that might be something to keep an eye on. Moving on to some of the dry mouth alternatives. Certainly the first one appeals to me greatly, semi-frozen tonic water and gin, and that can be actually really very, very refreshing to the mouth. Other things like semi-frozen fruit juice or freezing pieces of pineapple and then allowing the patient just to chew on those pieces of pineapple. Chipped ice, but be careful of that too, because it can actually cut the tongue. So, you know, make sure it's not little sharp pieces. Having frequent sips of cold water, or even using a cold water spray bottle, if people haven't got the energy to just keep sipping, then sometimes just having that spray can be helpful. Or, you know, having a sipper bottle close to them so they're not having to go and get a drink from somewhere or try and pour it out of a heavy jug. Using petroleum jelly on the lips will keep them nice and fresh. And the other thing that I used to find quite helpful was frozen Nystatin popsicles. So you actually put the Nystatin, if they're needing that because they've got some thrush, into sugarless fruit juice and then freeze it. And that was really good because it kept the Nystatin around in contact with the mucosa and tongue and that for longer. And people found that less unpleasant than some people find the Nystatin, especially if they've got those sweet cherry flavour to them. Another one that I used to use with people also was frozen or semi-frozen pineapple juice, egg white and yoghurt. And they found that very pleasant, and it sort of stayed around in the mouth and kept it feeling moist for a time. All right, I'll hand back to the doctor to talk about drugs.
Somebody once told me, and I have never really been able to verify it, that part of the reason for freezing the fruit segments is that there are enzymes in fruit and there are acids in fruit which break down the oral mucosa. And if you freeze the pineapple, for example, it breaks the enzyme. And so it's much better for the mouth to have frozen fruit chips than it is to have non-frozen fruit chips. So I think that's worth considering. It may be a myth, but I've believed it for 20 years. So just a quick word about drugs. One of the most useful drugs really is pilocarpine. It's been used for over 100 years, but sadly there isn't a pilocarpine tablet available in New Zealand. So we've tended to use the drops. Now the problem with the drops is that it's actually quite difficult to get a truly accurate dose variation. So one thing that you can do is to get a solution made up by your friendly pharmacist. So you have half a milligram per mil and you prescribe 500 mils, and the dose would be about 2.5 milligrams four times a day. If you give too high a dose, then you'll find that your patient is sweating and nauseated and has diarrhea, because that's what happens if you have an overdose of pilocarpine. And it's also important that you take care prescribing this for people with any degree of bronchospasm, because that can make that worse. But that can be quite an effective way of stimulating saliva. And just going back to have a word on the next slide about candidiasis. Sometimes we're quite reluctant to diagnose candidiasis, and sometimes it's diagnosed every day. What's true is that between a third and a half of us are carriers of oral candidiasis. And when people have done studies, and I think Laura Finlay was one of the first with a group of dental people in London to look at the presence of candidiasis, up to 89% of people with advanced cancer in her study were found to have oral candidiasis. Nystatin, which sits on bed lockers around the country, may not be the best option, because I think, it was Elora who demonstrated that an awful lot of these candidal infections were resistant to nystatin. And so the option of fluconazole, which comes in a handy tablet, a handy capsule form, is a very real one. I think you only have to take one capsule a day. Ketoconazole is an option, but people get nervous about ketoconazole because of its effect on the liver, which is worse than the effect of fluconazole on the liver. But I think perhaps one of the most important aspects to remember when you're treating candidiasis is that you have to remember to clean the dentures properly. And that doesn't just mean running them under tap with a little bit of a brush over and sticking them in a glass of water. They need to be taken out and soaked overnight in, I think, quarter-strength Milton will do. Now, that might be difficult for people who don't like to take their teeth out. But the candidal infection lives in the nooks and crannies in the false teeth. And unless you have an effective way of cleaning those, you're really never going to win. You're just putting an infected set of dentures back into a nice clean mouth. Okay, back to Anne to talk a little bit more about care plans, because that's the sort of nursey thing.
Oh, I'm from doctor nurse here. I want you to really be thinking about how do you report the findings of your assessment, because it's all very well, Rod's given us a really good summary of how we go about that assessment, but an assessment is only as good as the findings being documented somewhere. So how are you doing that documentation? Is everybody aware of it? Are all members of the team working along the same plan that has been developed with the patient? Because if there's only one or two people carrying out the plan, then it's not going to really work. So we need really good documentation, and that may be an interesting thing for some of you to audit in your hospices and residential care facilities. Offer oral care at least four times a day, after each meal and at bedtime. And again, that will be obviously discussion with the patient, and they may need some education along that. Some people have neglected their oral care for many years, and so they may need some encouragement. Using soft toothbrushes and mild flavoured toothpaste are important, I think, particularly with people with advanced disease or who've had some taste alteration from chemotherapy, radiation, or drug treatments. They sometimes can't really manage strong flavours in their mouth either, so be careful of that. Using plain swabs, if the person is unable to manage their own oral care and you're actually needing to use some form of swab, using a plain swab is better, so you can choose what solution is put onto that swab. Some of the commercially produced swabs have quite heavily impregnated with soda bicarbonate or other solutions, and actually they get pretty awful after you've had them in your mouth day after day. So be careful what you're using. We're going to talk more about the solutions that you might use in a minute, but if you're needing to use a swab, better to use a plain swab so you can have some control over what goes on to that swab. Drug therapy is necessary, as Rod has talked about. Make sure that they get it when they should be getting it. And the other thing that isn't done enough and certainly came out in many of the studies was the referral for dental treatment. It was often seen as a really last-ditch thing, whereas our dental colleagues would say, let us see these people earlier and let us help them maintain their oral integrity. And repeating, as Rod said, those oral assessments daily. It's not a thing you do when the person comes in and then it's not done for days and days afterwards. It has to be done daily, and it needs to be documented and the care plan changed as needed on a daily basis. And we need to be educating our colleagues about that, especially our less experienced colleagues about how we manage our oral hygiene. So some of the solution choices for oral care, Rod mentioned the glycerine and thymol. I was disturbed to see as I went around the country doing training for trainers for fundamentals, the number of lemon and glycerine swabs that are still being used. They're an absolute no-no. They should have been banned. And there's a good study there at the bottom. If you need to convince people that they shouldn't be used, that study mentioned talks about all of these things. They increase their oral dryness because of that dehydrating effect of glycerine and you get an overstimulation of the saliva from the lemon that's in the swabs. Now, if you sucked on a lemon all day, as we make people do if we're using these lemon and glycerine swabs, then you get actually an exhaustion of the saliva from the salivary glands. There's no evidence that they had any cleansing properties at all. What we do know is that the citric acid damaged the tooth enamel. It accelerated decalcification and it increased the likelihood of painful tooth sensitivity. And so I used to suggest to people who insisted still on using these that they might like to try sucking them several times a day and see how they felt by the end of the day. Okay, so moving on to the other solutions, I'll let Rod deal with the next two because they have drugs in them.
So what do you use then? Well, chlorhexidine is a very well established and well utilized oral solution. Dentists use it if you've had dental operations, but I think it's not something that you'd want to use over a long period of time. It's important that you don't use it more than once every 12 hours. It has antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-plaque activity, so it hits all those right notes. But it can be unpalatable for some, and it you'll know if you've used it yourself over more than 3 or 4 days that it can lead to taste alteration. And because it's an astringent, it can lead to increased oral pain. One important thing to remember with chlorhexidine is that if you're using it with nystatin, don't, because the two compete for the same binding sites, and one or other of them is going to lose out. And a significant disadvantage is that it's relatively expensive. But for short-term use, Not much that can better it. Something that is really cheap as chips is sodium bicarbonate. So the next slide we're on has sodium bicarbonate. And it's interesting, moving over to work in this facility at Greenwich Hospital where I'm working on a palliative care unit, an awful lot of the bedside lockers have got sodium bicarbonate bottles on. It's got mucolytic properties, and it neutralizes the oral environment, especially where there is infection. So it has that sort of buffering effect that that we mentioned before. It doesn't really have a very nice taste, so it can lead to non-compliance. And it's important to remember that you need to have a pretty low concentration of sodium bicarbonate because the mucosa of your mouth is quite delicate and it can be irritated by concentrations in excess of 1%. So those are two options. The options that don't have drugs in are allowed to be talked about by a nurse.
Oh, thank you, Rod. Okay. There are a number of mouthwashes, and some of you may use a mouthwash after you clean your teeth. They're quite pleasant tasting. They certainly have a deodorant effect, but they are expensive, and the efficacy for them is actually unknown. So while they might be a pleasant option, they're not always well tolerated if patients are feeling nauseated or if they're anorexic. So use them carefully and, again, in consultation with what people have done previously for themselves. So moving on to the next slide, water is as good as anything. It's widely used, it's well accepted, and it's a very effective mouthwash. Use it warm or cool. Don't go using icy cold water because if people have some tooth sensitivity, it's not going to be very pleasant for them, especially if you're needing to be the person doing the oral care with swabs or something. You can actually make people clamp down and not want a swab in their mouth. The other option is normal saline. It's very convenient and it's inexpensive again. And it's mildly antiseptic. It's non-irritant if it's kept in a solution. So, you know, a teaspoon to 500 mils is more than enough. Again, we run into this problem a bit with the patients who have altered taste or nausea, but sometimes that feeling of saltiness in their mouth can make them gag a bit. So, but you've got two easily available alternatives there that can be used very easily. Thinking about the person dying, clearly either you or the family are the person who will be attending to the oral care. You still need to be doing those regular assessments to make sure you're not missing anything, and encouraging regular moistening of the mouth. And I tended to offer the family the option to do this, and it was a good way for them to still feel that when their loved one wasn't able to eat anymore, that they weren't starving them to death, that they were still able to provide some love and care. And it allowed quite a degree of intimacy between the family members. And what they moistened the mouth with wasn't as important as how often it was moistened. So I always talked about using fluids that were familiar to the person and finding out what they used to like and encouraging them to use that. And I have a couple of lovely stories here. One of an elderly lady who was sitting with her dying husband, and she was desperate because she said, you know, you've got to feed him, and we talked a little about that. And she said, whenever he was sick, I always made him chicken broth. So I suggested that she made some chicken broth and that we diluted it a bit with some warm water. And she used to sit and moisten his mouth with a swab dipped in this chicken broth. And it meant that she was much calmer, and I believe he was much calmer too, because there was that recognition between the two of them of something that he understood. The other one was a gentleman I was called to see, Jack, who was very restless and distressed. And in talking with his son, I said, you know, is there anything that you can think of that may be causing this distress? Because the team on the ward were pressurising me to sedate this gentleman. And he said, oh, the poor old bugger's probably missing his brandy. And he went on to talk about the brandy that this gentleman used to have each night before he went to bed. And as a child, this son remembered that as a time where the family spent time sharing what had happened during the day, and always went with that brandy the fact that you never went to bed on an argument. So if there had been any unpleasantness during the day, that was the time where it was forgiven and forgotten. So I suggested to the son he went and got some brandy and bring it back, and he was a little worried that, you know, that he'd be told off. And I said, no, don't worry about that, because this wasn't an acute hospital. And he came back with the brandy, and his father was pretty much unconscious at this time, but quite unsettled. And I gave him some plain swabs and showed him how to gently swab his father's mouth, which he did. And his father calmed down amazingly, and we never did have to sedate that gentleman. And I always remember the next day going up to see how they were getting on and watching this adoring son swabbing his dad's mouth with the brandy, with big tears rolling down his face, and at the same time he was sucking on a swab covered in brandy as well. And it was a sight that really made me realise just how incredibly important from that whole spiritual being as well, the simple act of oral care at the end of life could be. So using lip balms again, but really thinking about what's important to this person, knowing that person, knowing about that person, talking with the family, and letting this be a really beautiful time that a family can share together. So moving on to the next slide about changing practice. This says we have spoken to you over this last hour. You think, we could do better. We could do some other things. What might they be? Maybe it's create and implement a new protocol around good assessment, documentation and planning of oral care, making it that clinical priority that we talked about earlier. Implementing staff education and regular updates. We do these regular updates of all sorts of other clinical practice areas, but how often do you get an actual update on oral care? And helping our care assistants who don't have the same benefit of the knowledge and understanding of how the mouth works, helping them to understand how important it is. Sometimes it's sort of the last thing they have to complete for the care of that person that day, and it's often perhaps shortcutted, and this certainly came through in some of the surveys that have been done. Should we be auditing our oral care practices? Is this a good audit? And maybe Rod might like to add something on that in the end. And providing information leaflets for patients and families. When I was working at the hospital, I created an oral care handout that I could give to families, just talking about some of the issues that are a problem, raising their awareness of the importance of telling the health professional and keeping on telling them until they do listen, and then looking at that very magical time at the end where they can share that time together doing the oral care. So there's some challenges there for you to look at. Where do we go from here? And I'm going to hand back to Rod to sum up and to also tell you about the palliative care handbook. Over to you, Rod.
Thank you, Anne. Well, here's the last slide, and it's just a summary, basically, of what we've been trying to tell you about. Anne was most insistent when we were putting this presentation together that we should have an evidence base that you could go and check for yourselves, and she's quite right. So throughout, we've dotted Anne has dotted some journal articles that are readily available for you to just go and see what other people have been doing. But as we were talking about putting this presentation together, I thought, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing that we could all do together, and a relatively simple thing, would be to do a nationwide mouth care audit. I'm not entirely sure how that would work. It would need a champion, and I know that there are some champions out there. I've left a few champions at Hospice North Shore, actually, who might like to take this on. But it would be quite easy using that slide number, whatever it was, 12, to produce a fairly simple audit form. I haven't asked Rachel Crombie about this, but perhaps Rachel Crombie and Anne could coordinate that from the Hospice New Zealand office if somebody wanted to take that on. I think it would be a really fascinating thing to do. Brian Ensor, over the last years, has been collecting data on opioid usage and use of tranquilizers and sedatives so that hospices can compare themselves with each other. And maybe mouth care, because it is such an important thing, would be a relatively easy and non-intrusive activity to do as well. So we hope that you've got something out of that. We've got a few minutes for questions, but just before those questions, I'm absolutely delighted to let you know that the Palliative Care Handbook has rolled off the printers, and if you haven't got it already, it should be with you in the next 2 or 3 days. It's in a new format, new branding, some new content, one or two spelling mistakes that we've overlooked, but I haven't seen it myself. I've only seen a photograph, but I'm very proud to have been part of that over so many years, and very grateful to the Genesis Oncology Trust, who provided funding for some of the books, and the Louise and Patrick Emmett Trust, who provided funding for some of the books, and for Hospice New Zealand coordinating and distributing the handbooks at no charge to you at all. Of course, you could make a donation to Hospice New Zealand, but we don't expect that. We hope it's valuable for you, and I wish you all well. So if there are any questions, we might try and answer them in the 2 or 3 minutes that we've got left. It's still dark in Sydney.
Oh, never mind.